We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about mylifeinabook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, mylifeinabook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice to text feature, and mylifeinabook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire, and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Having a family member go missing without a trace has to be one of the most heartbreaking experiences that a family can go through. When Alicia Mandy Stokes never returned from running errands on November 25th, 2007, her loved ones were plunged into a nightmare. They didn't know if she was safe, if she had harmed herself, or if someone had done something to her. As the days and weeks went on, their fear grew and their tragedy was compounded when another member of her family emerged as the prime suspect in her disappearance. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Mandy Stokes. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again.
And thank you for having me on this episode.
Oh my God. He got so bitter because I did that like mini episode on Lisa Jameson without him, but like he literally was gone. That's why we didn't do an episode last week. I just couldn't get anything together. And yeah, and he's giving me shit for it.
Yeah, I'm bitter.
Okay, but you know, I think that our listeners appreciated the fact that I put something out.
Yeah, I'm sure that they did. I'm just personally offended.
Well, I'm sorry. Like, you need to be here to record then.
I mean, tell my job that.
I would be happy to. Would you like me to email them?
Yes. If you could like somehow give me a get out of work.
Yeah.
Because I need to do my other job. That would be fantastic.
All right, perfect. I'll work on that.
Or maybe if we like made enough money off of this, I could quit my job.
No, you absolutely cannot. But regardless, like you're home, you've been home for a few days, you're going back to work, but we're working on this. We're trying to record and, you know, hopefully I won't have to do another one without you.
I guess we'll just have to see what the temperament of the country is.
But the point is I have more loyalty than to our listeners than I do to you. And so I will if I need to.
Ouch.
So also because, you know, of all the craziness and we kind of did a few things out of order when we did record, I haven't. I actually kind of missed a Patreon member from a little while ago.
Oh.
Maggie N., the one we actually know.
Oh, Maggie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hi.
So that was really exciting when I first saw her. Thank you very much, Maggie. We are so thrilled to have you here. And remember, if you'd like to join us on Patreon, you can get these episodes early and ad-free because, as you've probably noticed, we do have a good amount of ads on here now, but we still do them ad-free and as early as I can get them on Patreon. And I just got Ethan to start writing a new episode of his show today.
Yeah, I had to scrap my original idea because it really wasn't going anywhere, but then you gave me an idea and now I'm going to run with it.
Yeah. So hopefully that'll work out. So we'll hopefully have one of those pretty soon. Yeah. This episode on Mandy Stokes is really awful for a lot of reasons. One is that there have been so few developments in it over the years. I mean, this happened back in 2007. And another is that while there is a suspect, it's also possible that there was actually no crime that was committed in this case.
That's intriguing.
Yeah. There are two schools of thought on what happened to Mandy, and so I'll be interested in getting your take on it.
All right.
Alicia Amanda Stokes was born on August 19th, 1974 in North Carolina to Deborah and William Stokes. Alicia went by Mandy and was the oldest daughter in a family of 8 children.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mentioned that there weren't a ton of developments in this case. Similarly, there, you know, isn't a lot of information about her early life growing up. But Mandy was a smart, friendly girl who was close with her family, especially her father, William. Her brother, Cody, was interviewed for an episode of Disappeared, and he said that Mandy and their father had kind of like a similar personality and really got along well because of it. So when their father died suddenly of a heart attack, in December of 2003, Mandy was absolutely devastated.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, so Mandy, like I said, was the oldest daughter. So she was 29 at the time. So she was an adult. You know, she had, I don't know how old her youngest sibling was, but regardless, I mean, it doesn't matter what age it happens. Losing a parent like that is just heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, especially if it's unexpected.
Right, exactly.
I mean, not to say that it's any easier if you lose somebody due to a long illness or anything like that, but, you know, it just, it hits you differently.
By this point, Mandy had graduated college, and her father's life and death was a driving reason she wanted to continue school and become a therapist. So her father was a Vietnam veteran and spent decades dealing with PTSD because of it. And it sounds like he may have also suffered from depression. So I talked about that disappeared episode. You know, it's interesting because they don't actually say how he died in that episode. They just talk about how he died. And, you know, both Deb, Mandy's mom, and Cody, the brother who are in the episode, you know, talk about his PTSD and, you know, the struggles that he had. And the way they were talking about it made it sound as though he may have taken his own life. But again, I found another news article that said that he had died suddenly of a heart attack. Mandy really wanted to explore how the brain worked, and she did a lot of research into PTSD. In 2005, Mandy decided to continue her education and was accepted into John F. Kennedy University in Oakland, California, where she was studying to earn her PsyD. Now, a PsyD degree is an alternative doctoral degree that focuses on practical and clinical aspects of psychology. It basically revolves around getting students ready for practical placement. So it's not just like a theoretical, you know, let's learn the concepts of being a doctor. It is like, this is what you need to learn to work in a hospital or a clinic or, you know, whatever.
So it's more training oriented.
Exactly. Yeah. Luckily for Mandy, she already had a friend in Oakland, which is on the complete opposite side of the country from where...
From North Carolina, yeah.
So it's about 3,000 miles or 4,800 kilometers from North Carolina, just to give any of our non-American listeners an idea. Her best friend from childhood, Melinda Wiggins, was already there studying for her master's degree in acupuncture. So it worked out perfectly. Mandy moved in with her and the two friends like had a great time, you know, just working, studying and hanging out. Because, again, they were just so close. They grew up together. I mean, they considered each other more sisters than friends. So she really had just a safe place to land when she made this huge move. And this arrangement lasted for about a year or so until the spring of 2007, when Mandy's little brother, Aaron, also came to California. Aaron is about 4 years younger than Mandy, and by this point had already had some struggles in life. He had previously had some issues with drugs, so when Mandy asked Melinda if Aaron could crash on their couch, Melinda was a little bit apprehensive. But Mandy assured her that Aaron was clean, so she agreed. This arrangement lasted for a few months before Mandy and Aaron moved out and got a place together.
Was there anything that precipitated that, or was it just timing or whatever?
Well, it seems...
Like he didn't start falling back into drugs?
That isn't clear. But what Melinda did say is that she was concerned about Mandy, and we'll get into, you know, that in a little bit here. But their relationship did become a little bit strained toward the end. So I think that probably did contribute to Mandy moving out with Aaron. So after Mandy moved out, Melinda didn't really see her that much. And, you know, part of that was just due to their incredibly busy schedules.
Sure.
But part of it was because Mandy was having a difficult time. According to her friends and family, Mandy suffered from severe depression. Melinda told the Oakland Tribune that Mandy had kept an urn with her father's ashes in her bedroom, and events like his birthday or the anniversary of his death were really triggering to her, and they would cause her to slide deeper into depression. Toward the end of their time living together, Mandy was really struggling. She was self-medicating with alcohol and was apparently being a little reckless with men. It just really sounds like she was trying to fill a void that was inside of her.
Yeah.
Melinda said that Mandy would turn into a different person when she would drink, and it caused arguments between them. And I think we've all known that person, you know, and it's tough, especially if you're living with them. Mandy was also supporting herself while in grad school by working as a cocktail waitress. So she was constantly in the bar party culture, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, when you work at a bar and it's closing time, like, that is the staff's time to go party, basically.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
They need to wind down. Like, they're not ready to go to sleep. And so it's just, it keeps going.
Yeah, well, I have never worked in that scene. I have definitely closed out a bar and have had such good relationships with the bartenders that they then started drinking with us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I definitely understand how, you know, the whatever 11, 12, 1, 2 in the morning can suddenly turn into 4 a.m.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so it was one of these nights, though, these like normal, you know, after closing party nights, that something horrible happened to Mandy. She came home and told Melinda that she had been sexually assaulted. Mandy never reported the assault to the police, and Melinda tried to help her through it as best as she could. But Mandy was spiraling, and it eventually became too much for Melinda to handle. By the time Mandy and Aaron moved out of the apartment, the relationship between the lifelong friends was strained. After the move, it seems as though Mandy was also trying to make some changes in her life. She had decided to take the semester off of school. She just wasn't happy with her current position in life. Like, it just wasn't working out in the way that she had hoped it would. She was worried about her career prospects, her friendships, her drinking, like everything, you know, nothing felt right to her. Now, throughout all this turmoil, though, Mandy actually had a boyfriend, a man named John Krug. He and Mandy had met a few years before when they were both on vacation in Las Vegas.
Oh.
Yeah. So she, of course, lived in California, and John lived on the other side of the country in New York City.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, they hit it off. And so they started like a casual long distance relationship,
mm-hmm.
you know, like she was obviously like seeing other people. I'm assuming he was, too. It wasn't, you know, it had been going on for like a couple years. But again, not super serious.
Sure, sure.
But in the months leading up to her disappearance, I heard like in the last 4 months or so, they did kind of start to get a little bit more serious.
Now, was he still living in New York?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so actually she flew to New York a few times to visit him. And in October of 2007, she actually spent a month there.
Oh.
Yeah. So again, this is like the semester she was taking off of school.
Sure. Yeah. But that's got to impact your job.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so she was gone for a month, so I don't know about her whole money situation or, you know, what was going on. But the trip went really well, according to both of them. You know, they explored the city. They even, like, got out of the city and went camping. You know, they did all sorts of stuff. And Mandy fell in love with New York and was seriously considering making that her next chapter. So she was considering moving to New York, you know, I think to be with John or just, you know, for a new start.
Mm-hmm.
She apparently was also talking about possibly moving to Atlanta where her mom was living at the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So basically it sounded like her time in California may have been coming to an end one way or the other. Mandy flew back to California on November 20th, 2007 and told Aaron about her decision, you know, basically that she would be leaving. And he did not take it well.
Mm.
From what it sounds like, Mandy was not only providing Aaron with emotional support as the big sister, but a good amount of financial support as well.
Mm.
Like, it sounds like she was kind of paying all the bills. You know, her name was the only name on the apartment. Stuff like that. Like, I haven't read anything about him having a job. I don't know if he did, what he was doing, what the situation was there.
That's got to be tough. I mean, I know bartenders and servers can make a lot of money, but still, LA basically providing for two people.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was.
That's a lot.
It was a lot. A few days before her disappearance, Mandy called their mother, Deb, and asked her to talk to Erin. She basically wanted her mom to, like, step in and do her mom magic.
Yeah.
And, like, help Erin realize that, you know, everything was going to be okay. And, like, Mandy just needed to move on. You know, she just needed somebody to help her out.
Yeah.
But her impending move continued to be a sore spot between the siblings. They argued a few times about it, and from what it sounds like, the biggest one was the morning of November 25th. Now, this is, again, just 5 days after she returned from that month-long trip to New York. That morning, neighbors reported that they heard the siblings arguing from about 8 to 10 a.m. outside of their apartment.
Hmm. It's a long argument.
Yeah, exactly. I think this was like an open air apartment building, you know?
So like a breezeway.
Yeah, like a breezeway. Exactly. Thank you. I could not think of that word. instead of like an enclosed building, but mm-hmm. I still think it's probably pretty easy to hear, you know, if not exactly what they're saying, like that there's a fight.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
One neighbor even witnessed the end of the argument and was, I guess, able to catch kind of what it was about. And that neighbor said that it seemed to be over money. And Mandy was kind of complaining that she was paying for Erin all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The neighbor also said that Erin was like cornering her and that Mandy basically had to do like a football maneuver to get around him and like run into the apartment.
Oh.
Yeah, but Erin followed closely behind, but then nobody heard or saw anything after that. According to Erin, he and his sister just had a little disagreement. That's how he has always described that morning. Afterwards, you know, after they went back into the apartment, he says that he got in the shower. While he was in there, he said that Mandy tapped on the bathroom door and told him that she was going to run some errands. He yelled that he loved her, and then she left. She was wearing running pants, and she took her wallet, ID, cell phone, and iPod with her. She then got into her car and drove away, and she was never seen again.
So this was according to Erin?
Yes.
And so we have neighbors that witnessed the fight, but do we have any neighbors that witnessed her actually leaving?
I do not believe so. And so that's the thing. So when you hear this, your first thought probably is that something more happened during this fight.
Well, clearly. I mean, Erin's the last person to see her alive. He admits that there was an argument.
Yeah. Although he downplays
it. He downplays it, sure. But you have witnesses, neighbors that hear and see an actual argument taking place.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it kind of paints him in a bad light, no matter how he cuts it.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And that's what I would think, you know, that maybe Mandy never made it out of the apartment, at least not under her own volition.
And what time of day? This was morning, you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
this also like this. Yeah. She left allegedly, you know, around 10 a.m.
to run errands. Mm-hmm. And then we have no witnesses seeing her leave or.
Right.
You know, nobody out in the general public saying that they saw her car or her at wherever she was running errands. She just seemingly disappeared in the middle of the day.
Correct. But even though no one saw Mandy after she left at 10 a.m., they did hear from her.
Oh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Around 10:45 a.m., she called her boyfriend from the car.
Okay.
They spoke for a short time, and she vented about the fight that she had just had with Erin. But in the middle of their conversation, the call got cut off, either from her losing service or from the phone being shut down.
Hmm.
Or the battery dying.
The battery dying.
One of the three. John tried to call her back repeatedly, but he was never able to reach her.
Now, when he tried calling her back, did it go straight to voicemail or did it just ring endlessly?
So, yeah, that's a good question. I know that it did go straight to voicemail. I'm not sure if like it immediately went straight to voicemail.
Gotcha.
Like the very first time he called back, I'm not sure if it rang or not. But I do know that at some point it did just start going straight to voicemail. And cell phone records do back this account up. the phone either went dead or was shut off at 11:20 a.m. So I guess that would indicate that it probably didn't ring at all.
Right. Yeah.
Or again, at 11:20 a.m., maybe it did ring. Maybe his first call was at 11:18 a.m. And, you know, but in any case, went dead, shut off 11:20 a.m. on November 25th, 2007.
Never came back on.
No. So we do know that Mandy did make it out of the apartment that morning. It's what happened afterwards that remains a mystery.
So you said that she called her boyfriend, correct?
Yes.
So, did the police ever look into the cell phone records as far as where that call pinged from?
Where Mandy's?
Yes.
I assume so. They never really gave a lot of any public information about that, though.
Okay. Because, you know, incoming calls aren't geolocated.
Yeah.
But outgoing calls are.
Right.
At least to a proximity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I'm sure, again, that was a part of it, but I don't know.
Okay.
Mandy never returned to the apartment on November 25th. And Aaron apparently just assumed that she was pissed at him and decided to take a breather. It wasn't until the next day, which was a Monday, that Aaron thought that something could be wrong. So he called his mother on Monday afternoon and told her that Mandy hadn't come home the night before. And her mom was, you know, somewhat worried, but she wasn't panicking or anything.
Sure.
According to Mandy's brother, Cody, Mandy had a habit of taking short trips, going to stay with friends for a few days, you know, things like that. So while it was kind of out of character, it wasn't completely out of character, not enough to, you know, sound every alarm. So initially, you know, that's just kind of what they all thought was happening, especially given the argument, you know. But by Tuesday, they still hadn't heard from her. So that's when Deb really started to worry. Between Monday and Tuesday, she had tried calling Mandy several times with no luck. She left messages, but received no response. Not answering and not getting back to her mother was completely out of character for her. The two talked just about every single day, and Mandy just didn't stop answering her phone. That's just not something she did.
Right. Plus, by this point, multiple people have called her, and it's going straight to voicemail.
Exactly.
So, you know, clearly the phone is off.
Yeah. And yeah, that's just not a good sign.
Right.
So Deborah called Aaron to verify that he still hadn't heard from his sister. And when he confirmed that he had not, she asked him to call the Oakland police and report her missing. But Aaron didn't file the report.
Hmm.
So this is on Tuesday, and she said that when she called Aaron the next day, he made a bunch of excuses like, oh, like I tried, but I think I called the wrong person, like just dumb stuff like that.
Hmm.
So Deborah, who I mentioned was living across the country in Atlanta, Georgia at the time, called and made the report herself.
This really isn't looking good for Aaron so far.
Yeah, it's not looking great. And at this point, it had been around 72 hours or so since Mandy had last been seen. So the Oakland Missing Persons Unit did dispatch officers to the apartment that Mandy and Aaron shared, but Aaron refused to let them in.
Ah. Now the question is that because of his drug habit, or is it something more nefarious?
Well... Yeah, exactly. No, like you and I are on the exact same wavelength because you're absolutely right. Aaron used to have a drug problem. And apparently before this, he had relapsed and he more than likely did have drugs in the apartment. And so he didn't want to let the police in. And again, you know, is this completely rational? Like, no, but people who are high aren't generally known for their rational decision making.
Sure. And it's important to note that, you know, if they were allowed access, the drugs would be something that they could arrest Aaron on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's not like this is a search warrant where they have specific things that they're looking for. If you let them in and illegal activity is afoot and out in the general area where they can see it, like, You're going to jail.
Yeah. I mean, you know, given that they're the missing persons unit, would they actually bother? Who knows? Yeah,
probably not. But
you can understand why Aaron might have been concerned.
Yeah, for
you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So let's take a little detour and talk about the drugs for a moment. During the course of this investigation, it was confirmed that not only was Aaron using drugs again, but Mandy had started as well.
Oh.
And she was doing so with her brother.
Do we know what type of drugs they were using?
I don't know. Possibly heroin, possibly meth, but I'm not entirely sure. Yeah, we're not talking weed. I can tell you that much. Yeah. I mean, maybe we are, but that's not the problem.
Yeah.
I don't know the specifics, but apparently Mandy was using to some degree in addition to abusing alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
She also met some rather unsavory people through her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring this up because it could be relevant when it comes to the possible theories about what happened to Mandy. So back to the initial investigation. Since Mandy left in her car, the next logical step was to try to find the car.
Yeah.
Now, I would have assumed that the police could have gotten this information from the DMV, like her car information.
Sure.
But apparently, Deb ended up calling Mandy's insurance company and like begged them to give her Mandy's license plate number. And so she then called the missing persons unit and gave them the information, which just seems like a very long and convoluted way to do that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know if it's like a situation of like maybe Mandy still had her car registered back in like North Carolina or something.
Maybe, yeah.
And maybe they couldn't access that information in a timely manner. You know?
It still seems like something a phone call could have accomplished.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just thought that was just kind of weird.
Yeah.
But in any case, they did receive the information. And once they put it into whatever database that they did have access to, they found a match. On the same day that Deborah had reported Mandy missing, so that was the Tuesday, after she went missing on a Sunday, Mandy's 2001 black Honda Accord had been towed. And it was towed because it was blocking traffic next to a ravine at the 5,000 block of Park Boulevard near Leimert Boulevard in Oakland.
Mm.
Now, even though it was blocking traffic, it was found turned off and locked. And so it's very irritating that police didn't look for this car earlier,
right.
But they had it, which is very good in terms of the investigation.
And in theory, there's crime scene integrity, if that is a crime scene. But.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's exactly. Because what this made me think of was the Logan Schindelman case, where something similar had happened. His car was found abandoned on the side of a highway, but nobody knew that it was tied to a missing persons case. So it was any evidence was just like completely
right. People had
compromised.
Gone, yeah, people had gone through the car, inventoried it, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't seem like that had really happened in this case. It was towed. It was just sitting in an impound lot, but it doesn't sound like anybody had gone through it or done anything at that point. So when investigators went to the lot and searched the car, they found Mandy's wallet with her ID, along with her iPod and her phone.
So everything that she had with her.
Except for her keys.
Yeah.
So this obviously doesn't look good. But Mandy's family didn't immediately jump to foul play. Instead, their first fear was that she had harmed herself. I mentioned that Mandy had suffered from depression. While she had never attempted suicide to anyone's knowledge or even talked about it, some who were closest to her thought that she absolutely could have been heading down that path. In fact, her boyfriend John was certain that's what had happened when he gave one of his only media interviews to the East Bay Times in January of 2008, just under 2 months since his girlfriend was last seen.
Yeah, so I was wondering what he was doing during all this. I mean, you know, not judging.
Yeah.
But go ahead. I want to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, he told reporters that while they had a great time when she was in New York, Mandy had, quote, a complete mental breakdown, end quote, after she returned to California.
Mm.
He went on to say, quote, She was suicidal that Thursday after she left New York. I figured she would be okay just being there. I never thought of her disappearing, end quote.
So, I mean, what does that mean, him saying she was suicidal? I mean, like, did she come out and tell him that? Is this something that he was inferring from a conversation they had?
It sounds like something he was inferring, but I don't, you know, he's never gone more into depth publicly. Mm. But to answer your question of like what he was doing, he actually did fly out to California and he joined Mandy's friend Melinda along with her mother and brother Cody, who also flew to California to search for Mandy and hand out flyers.
But not Aaron.
Well, so yeah, it's interesting because it didn't sound like he was super involved in the search, but then I did hear an interview with Deb later, like many years later, where she kind of talked about how he did like go out and hand out some flyers at some point.
Okay.
So I don't know. It doesn't seem like he was super involved, but maybe not completely uninvolved either.
Gotcha.
So the group who did search went all through the ravine, which is where, you know, where her car was found.
Yeah.
And they were just hoping to find some evidence of what had happened. Now, this was December 4th, which was about a week or so after Mandy was reported missing and almost 2 weeks since she actually went missing. Now, during the search, they were approached by a man, and he told them that he lives nearby and walks his dog in the area. He had noticed one of the missing posters that they had put up, so he asked about Mandy and if that's, you know, what they were doing there, basically.
Mm-hmm.
They told him that, yes, they were. And they mentioned, you know, that her car had been found nearby. And he was like, oh, yeah, I remember that car. I wrote it down in my notebook. So he pulls out this journal and shows them the entry. And it said that he saw Mandy's car parked oddly at 3 p.m. on Sunday, November 25th, the day she went missing.
Hmm.
Yeah. So this is interesting for a few reasons. One, it's helpful because it helps narrow down the timeline. Whatever happened to Mandy likely happened between about 10:30 to 10:45 a.m. and 3 p.m. on November 25th.
Right.
But also, like, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah. Just, like, journaling odd things that he sees in his neighborhood?
Yeah, and just, like, approaching them and, like, inserting himself into the investigation.
Yeah,
and so both Deb and Mandy's brother Cody were like, is this guy like holding Mandy in a dungeon or something? Like, what is happening? They were just really creeped out by the whole situation.
Sure.
And Cody said on that Disappeared episode that like he was ready to follow this guy and break down the door to his apartment because he was like, this guy has to have something to do with it. But as it turns out, the man had a very good reason for keeping such a weird and detailed journal. He suffered from short-term memory loss. So he writes down everything that happens to him throughout the day so he can go back and reference it. So like it's memento without the tattoos.
I was just going to say, is he covered in tattoos to remind him of who he is?
Exactly.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Also go watch that movie. It's really good.
Yeah. Of course, like the police looked into him as well. And that's how all this was determined and whatever. And so, you know, eventually it turns out that the man was just like a helpful witness. Again, so that did help because it helped narrow things down. And police did keep investigating. On December 12th, Aaron ended up being interrogated by police for 9 hours.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Think they had something to go on there?
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Everything that I've been bringing up to this point, probably?
Yeah, I mean, basically. Now, interesting, like the only time I've ever found any situation in which Aaron has spoken publicly was the same article that I mentioned that John was interviewed for.
Mm-hmm.
So he, again, downplayed the argument that that he and his sister had on November 25th. He called it a tiff. And he also talked about the interrogation, saying, quote, I tried to talk to them, but they kept railroading and accusing me, end quote. And interestingly, so, you know, now that we're talking about Aaron as a suspect, I think it's interesting because if I had been interrogated for 9 hours by the police as a suspect in a disappearance. And her boyfriend had told the paper that he thought that she had harmed herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew of her history of depression, and I had actually had something to do with her disappearance. Personally, I would play up that history of depression and really like lean into the, yeah, no, her car was by a ravine. I think it's clear what happened here. She harmed herself. But that's not what Aaron did. He told the newspaper, quote, "There's a part of me that thinks she's very much alive and knows what's going on. I don't think she committed suicide," end quote. When asked if he could think of anyone who would want to harm Mandy, he couldn't think of anyone.
Except for himself.
Well, yeah, but so he didn't take the opportunity to push the suicide theory, and he also didn't take the opportunity to suggest an alternate suspect, basically. Like one of their drug friends or whatever.
His whole behavior just seems odd to me. Why postulate this even more bizarre theory that she's alive and out there?
Right.
And knows, quote unquote, knows what's going on. Like, what? Why?
Yeah, that is weird because by this point, like, no one else thinks that she just took off.
Right. All signs point to either foul play or suicide.
Exactly. And that's pretty much what everybody, including her family, was, you know, operating under.
Right. And we've gone over cases before where people leave, like, supposedly leave to start a brand new life. And wallet yeah. left behind, the items that you would need in order to start a new life.
And even your iPod, because back then, like, that couldn't be traced. That was life. You know?
Yeah.
Like, there was no Bluetooth. There was, right. You could just take that.
Yeah.
You know, you need some tunes if you're going to go start a new life.
Also, why go through the if you're going to start a new life randomly like that, like, why go through the effort of, like, hanging up in the middle of a phone call with your boyfriend and then leaving your car someplace where it could easily be found?
Yeah, exactly. And she didn't take any money with her.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, which we'll get to her bank accounts in a minute, but like, yeah, there's, it's just not a theory that anybody actually believed. So it's very strange that he was saying that in, like, from what I could find, his only public statement.
Mm-hmm. So who knows if he actually said that to the police, but...
I have no idea.
Yeah, even just putting it out there, it seems stupid, asinine, I don't know.
Yeah. So getting back to the suicide theory, you know, we talked about how Mandy was known to suffer from depression, and we talked about how she was self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. Plus, her car was parked in traffic next to a ravine.
Right.
Like, none of this sounds good.
Right, but she took her keys with her and locked the car.
I don't know. I mean, that doesn't necessarily tell me that she didn't jump or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. That seems strange to me that you would just, I don't know. Maybe it means nothing. I have no idea.
Well, right. So, you know, those are all the things that are pointing towards suicide. However, there are a few things that could point away from it. At the time of her disappearance, Mandy was actively trying to get her drinking under control. She was taking a medication called Antabuse. This medication is used for people who are trying to stop drinking. It makes the user physically ill if they ingest even a small amount of alcohol.
Are there any other side effects? Is there any...
like psychological side effects, you mean?
Yeah, or any... other like interactions with other drugs.
So in terms of side effects, it basically just says obviously avoid alcohol, but be really careful about products that contain small amounts of alcohol, including like astringent, like for your face, perfume, you know, mouthwash, things like that, because that could also cause a reaction. Mm. But again, you know, the reaction that it would cause would be like nausea, dizziness, fast heart rate, things like
that. Not necessarily something that would lead somebody who was depressed into a further depression.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it.
Okay.
So yeah, so she's on this drug. She's apparently trying to get her drinking under control. And then there's the ravine itself. Now, while this was certainly a dangerous area, like it's, you know, there's a road, there's traffic, we're not talking a giant cliff or okay. anything like that. Because to me, when I saw, when I heard ravine in California, like I was thinking of like
big cliff,
yeah. like, you know, where
literally a jumping off point.
Exactly. But I looked on Google Earth and it's not like that. Like, yes, if you jumped, you could certainly hurt yourself, possibly die, but you wouldn't just disappear. You know, like there's no water around.
I was just going to ask if there was a river at the base.
No, nothing like that. I mean, there are trees and like brush, so maybe sure. you wouldn't be like immediately seen from the top or anything like that.
Right, but you said people searched the ravine.
Well, exactly.
Volunteers did.
Yeah, exactly. And so this, just again, from what I was able to see on Google Earth, this really sounds like a place that if you're searching for somebody very soon, within a couple of days after they would have gone over the edge, it doesn't seem like there would be any way in which you wouldn't be able to find them. Hmm. You know, if we're talking months later, like, sure.
Yeah, sure. Animals getting...
Exactly. Like any number of things.
Even then, there would still be clothing. Yeah.
Yeah. But a few days, like they would have found something, and they found nothing. No clothing, no keys, you know, no evidence whatsoever. As Oakland Police Captain Ursie Joyner put it to Disappeared, quote, "It's kind of hard for you to kill yourself and then dispose of your own body," end quote.
It's a fucked up thing to say, but very
he's
on
not
point.
Wrong
no, very on point.
Yeah, and so like they were like they pretty much ruled out suicide after searches of the ravine had been done. So Oakland police continued their investigation and they found something big. Money had been withdrawn from Mandy's account after her disappearance. While this initially seemed like an amazing turn of events, it was quickly determined that the withdrawals had not been made by Mandy.
Okay, but that means that somebody has her debit card, right?
Yep.
So could they narrow it down to an ATM?
They could. They absolutely could. And they did.
Footage of the suspect?
Pulled the footage.
Okay.
And it was discovered that Aaron had used... Yeah,
mother...
Yep.
Okay. So do we know what he said in response to that?
Yeah. Yes, we do. But before we get to that, in addition to the ATM withdrawals, it was then found that he had also written checks to himself using her checkbook.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this totaled between $6,000 and $7,000.
It's a lot of money for a user.
Mm-hmm. There were also credit card purchases, and I don't know if this is her debit card or like a different credit card, but one purchase was made at 11:28 a.m. on the day she disappeared, just 3 blocks from her apartment. A second purchase was made at 11:51 a.m., 5 blocks from where her car was eventually found. Now, we don't have footage of these purchases, just the ATM footage.
Right, but you said her wallet was in the car.
Yeah.
So, but missing her debit card, obviously.
Yeah.
Or several credit cards or something.
Right, yeah. Now remember, her phone shut off at 11:20 a.m. So that second purchase was made a half an hour after that. Aaron also made cash withdrawals on the day after Mandy was last seen, so on that Monday.
When he... reported but didn't report her missing?
No, that wasn't until Tuesday.
That was Tuesday.
Okay. Yeah. Now, according to their mother, Mandy did let Aaron use her cards occasionally. But on that day, he nearly cleaned out her account.
Right. And some of these purchases, the purchases in particular, are around where her car was.
Right.
So do we know what those purchases are?
I think they were just at like a gas station or convenience store. It was just like something small. Like it wasn't anything, you know, whatever. But yeah, so we don't know if they were made by her, if they were made by Aaron or, you know, an unknown third person. We don't know anything about that. But yeah, I think they were just like gas station type purchases. Now, and I think, so all of this, all of these discoveries, I believe is what actually led to police finally bringing Aaron in on December 12th and interrogating him for the 9 hours. Mm-hmm. Because December 13th and 14th, he ended up spending in jail on charges related to this, like the fraud, nothing regarding her disappearance, sure, just the financial stuff.
Yeah.
Leading up to all this, Aaron continued to refuse to allow the police access to the apartment.
Yeah, I was wondering if they had ever gotten in there.
Not while it was up to him. But he ended up moving out in early December. Apparently, their lease was up. And, you know, I'm sure he also didn't have the money to pay for it anymore.
Right.
Their family was then faced with the heartbreaking task of packing up Mandy's belongings just a few weeks after her disappearance, not knowing if she would ever need any of it again. Shortly after Mandy's family left California, they received disturbing news. Mandy's case was being turned over to the homicide division. Basically, given the fact that Mandy had been out of contact for several weeks, coupled with what police deemed suspicious behavior on the part of her brother, Aaron, they believed that Mandy had met with foul play. Aaron was interviewed on the 12th. He spent the 13th and 14th in jail, but by that time, he was already out of the apartment. So on December 14th, police were able to get a warrant to search the apartment that Mandy and Aaron had shared.
Okay, forensics. What did we come up with?
Yeah, well, it was interesting because even though the apartment had been cleaned and already turned over to new tenants, investigators were able to uncover what they called biological evidence.
Right.
They don't go into specifics about what was actually found, but Captain Joyner said on Disappeared that they used chemicals to determine two different places where they believed an altercation had taken place. So to me, that sounds like they used luminol and found blood.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I would think, too.
And so this discovery led them to take a second look at Mandy's car. When they did, they found what they called the same biological evidence.
Mm-hmm.
This evidence indicated that either another altercation had taken place inside of the car or that a body had been transported inside.
Right.
So at this point, the homicide investigators believe that Aaron murdered his sister and staged the scene to look like she either ran off or died by suicide. They were so confident that they took their case to the DA and tried to have Aaron brought up on murder charges. But no body homicides are incredibly difficult to prove, so ultimately the DA determined that they didn't have enough evidence to move forward.
There's also that phone call to her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
That you said was made in a car, in her car.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of changes the timeline a little bit, because if she was already out of the apartment, it makes you wonder when or how that actually, how that could have been done, you know? So if they found evidence in the apartment and then blood evidence, or biological evidence in the car also, and then that phone call happened, the timeline is a bit messy.
It is. It's confusing because, again, that phone call, you know, pretty much proves that when they had their argument, Mandy didn't go into the apartment where Aaron harmed her, right? And then, transport her out of there because, again, she was known to have been alive and unharmed after that.
After that, outside of the apartment.
Exactly. So there are a couple of options. One, Aaron truly had nothing to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
And two, that maybe the first part of his story is correct, that he was in the shower, you know, or whatever. Mandy said, hey, I'm going to run some errands. She left. She called her boyfriend, vented about the fight. Something happened to her phone. I mean, maybe it ran out of batteries, whatever. She went back to the apartment, and then something happened at that point.
Mm-hmm. It just seems strange that we have an eyewitness, you know, seeing them in the heat of an argument.
Right.
And then she leaves and then comes back, and then he kills her. Do you know what
I
mean?
Right, yeah, no, I know.
Because this, believe me, Aaron, to me, seems shady as shit. But, and obviously he's, would be my prime suspect as well, because things aren't adding up. But the timeline is just a little fuzzy. So if you have no body, and this is what I was getting to, like, you have no body, the timeline is a little messy, that's going to be really hard to convince a jury that he did anything.
Yeah. And, you know, depending on, again, if the biological evidence was blood and right. how much there was and everything, right. you know, it's found in her house, her car. Like, there are any yes. number of reasons that your blood could be in your house and or your car.
Depending on the quantity.
Well, yes. that's what I mean. And we don't know the quantity, yeah. right? So, like, you know, you're right. There's just nothing solid enough.
Yeah. And you could even explain away his shady behavior afterwards because he's a fucking drug addict.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
He has access to her money and she's not around.
Yeah.
I mean, who's to say that he didn't do things like this before when she was alive?
Well, exactly.
And around.
Yeah.
So, again, still number one suspect in my mind, but there's not solid enough evidence to take it to court.
No, exactly. And so, yeah, you can totally see why this didn't go to trial back in 2008 when this was, you know, all being discovered. Mandy's family hasn't spoken to media about her case very often. There were a few interviews in the weeks after her disappearance, and then there was the Disappeared episode. That episode was filmed about 4 years after Mandy was last seen. And either Mandy's mom, Deb, her brother, Cody, or her friend, Melinda, agreed with the conclusion that investigators came to. Deb even went so far as to express dismay that police never really looked into any suspects other than her son. Cody admits that he was no longer close to his brother and really hadn't been in, you know, the few years leading up to all of this. But he said that there's no way he could believe that Aaron would have done anything to Mandy. And even Melinda, you know, who's not in the family and probably didn't really like Aaron that much, he believes that he's innocent, though she did say that she thought he knew more than he was letting on and could have possibly been involved in some way.
Right. Right. Because there is that other possibility. I mean, you're talking drugs, you're talking drug dealers.
Yeah.
I mean,
right. It definitely ups the likelihood of you being a victim of violent crime,
mm-hmm.
right? When you're, you know, involved in people like that, with people like that. But yeah, it's just, yeah, it was a Sunday morning. Like, I don't know, you know? And again, if something like that had happened, would it have happened in her apartment that right. morning? You know, like, how do you explain the biological evidence found in her apartment at right. that point?
Yeah. Unless one of the errands she was running was trying to score,
mm-hmm.
and or maybe she or Aaron, maybe Aaron reached out to a dealer who then came to the apartment. And then when she came back,
something happened then. But then what about her car? Like, you know, if it was drugs, if it was whatever, like, would they have left behind her iPod and her wallet and all that kind of stuff?
Probably not.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, especially if you're a dealer or user or whatever, that's something that you can sell
yeah.
for money to score more drugs.
Right.
So, yeah, none of this is adding up.
No, it's not. It's really not. Deb appeared on an episode of the Unfound podcast in 2018 where she talked about the Disappeared episode, which she says she's never actually watched. And she says that she didn't go on there to incriminate her son, you know, which, again, Aaron does come off as looking very guilty based on that episode. She just wanted to find out what happened to her daughter, you know, like she wanted to get her story out there because, again, this is 4 years later. Nothing new had happened in her case at all. And so she just thought that going on this show could help in some way. And, you know, it sounds like, and again, in the episode it Disappeared, and then even when she was being interviewed on this podcast in 2018, at this point, 11 years after her daughter was last seen, it sounds like she still believed that Aaron was innocent. Aaron, though, according to Deb, did watch the episode. And he was extremely upset by the way he was portrayed and what he viewed as a betrayal by his mother. Mm. And she said that he wouldn't speak to her for years afterwards. Aaron ended up leaving California and moving to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, shortly after all of this happened. According to the public records I could find, it seems as though he's mainly stayed out of trouble, but that he has continued to struggle with drug use. In January of 2011, just over 3 years after everything happened in California, Aaron was arrested in Oklahoma for forging a prescription for painkillers, specifically Norco and Tramadol. Apparently, the prescription for Tramadol was legit, but he just, like, wrote Norco on the prescription.
Brilliant.
Yeah, right? Like, it seems like a pretty dumb crime in terms of, like, dumb crimes. Like, what doctor is putting two narcotics on one prescription? Like, that's not how that works at all. Like, even your prescriptions for friggin' eye drops, like...
two different prescriptions.
Yeah.
Two different actual pads, which was also weird that they wouldn't just call it in.
I know, that was annoying. Like, but regardless,
yeah,
two different prescriptions, two different pieces of paper.
Right.
And so, like, this is so... I don't know. It bothers me because I don't know how it makes me feel. Like, I don't know if it makes me think that Aaron is more guilty or more innocent of his sister's presumed murder. Because it tells me...
that he doesn't plan well?
Well, exactly. So how can he be clever enough to murder his sister and dispose of her body where she hasn't been found for 18 years?
Right.
All in a matter of hours.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the car was found just over 3 hours after she was last seen. So he apparently came up with all of this on the fly. But he just wrote Norco on a prescription and thought that would work?
Yeah. I mean, again, none of this adds up. One way or the other. I don't believe that she just, like, up and started a new life.
No.
Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Not at all.
Same thing that we were talking about with suicide. If she had jumped off,
she would have been found. Ravine.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, something would have been found.
Yeah.
And then the timeline of a possible murder in her apartment doesn't really work either.
Right. And again, unless she came back and then something happened afterwards. Right. I just don't know.
But then we're left with a 3-hour window for this.
This whole thing to get covered up.
Right. Her brother and or maybe somebody else masterfully disposing of her body, having never been found again.
Right.
Plus cleaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to consider cleaning the car, too. Because they said that they found trace amounts of or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Because the police had already searched the car. They found her iPod. They didn't find her iPod and a puddle of blood.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know?
So they would have had to have cleaned the car, too, before they disposed of it. And that's the 3-hour window. They probably, in theory, had more time to clean the apartment if that's where the crime occurred.
Yeah, because nobody searched the apartment for weeks.
Right. But 3 hours to hide to put the body somewhere, hide the body, then clean the car, and then stage it to make it look like she committed suicide. That's, and presumably, kind of done on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that just doesn't seem realistic.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that kind of would work would be something happened in the apartment, she died in the apartment, was kept in the apartment, and then the car was taken to the place where it was found and left, and then whatever happened to her body was done later,
right? But
with more time.
But then they found biological evidence in the car too.
Exactly. So that's the main thing about that. However, if the car was driven by the murderer, maybe Mandy's blood was transferred from that person.
Yeah, maybe.
You know?
Sure.
Because again, we don't know where it was found, how much, any of those details. So that might not make any sense, but it could, right? Like, if you killed somebody, you could have that person's blood on you. If you get into a car, you can transfer that blood into the car.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, we don't know what the amount of
right
bodily fluids
Yeah. So maybe this wasn't all done in 3 hours. Maybe just the car was disposed of in 3 hours and the general plan was put into action and the actual body disposal took much longer.
Yeah.
I don't know. So yeah, so back to, you know, what happened with Aaron, like that prescription crime has followed him for over a decade. According to the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, instead of being convicted and sent to prison initially, he was ordered to do drug court. Now, can you talk a little bit about what drug court is?
In most jurisdictions, it's a diversion tactic to keep somebody who has a minor drug offense out of, or drug-related offense out of jail. So diversion tactics, drug court, it could be community service. You could be sentenced to...
like a treatment program.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Not necessarily a halfway house, but some sort of treatment program, something like that.
Yeah. Just, whether it's inpatient, outpatient, just right. something.
Yeah.
And yeah, but like from what I understand, you have to, there are, it's kind of like being on probation, like, or, you know, there are certain things that you have to do.
Yeah. And in more instances than not, you would actually would have a probation officer following your case, and there are milestones that you have to reach. And then once you get to a certain point, depending on the jurisdiction, some will expunge your record, mm-hmm. or at least that record, or others will just, you know, rubber stamp saying you're done. It just really depends on the jurisdiction.
Yeah. And so again, this is Oklahoma City. And from what I could see, like I said, just from the DOC records, he was in the drug court program until December of 2014. So after that, it gets a little cloudier. I don't know if he was sentenced to probation, but on September 22nd, 2020, so like 9 years later, after the initial crime, he was convicted of the same charge with the same case number. That, to me, sounds like... like a probation violation, maybe?
Yeah, I'm not really sure how they would do that.
Yeah, I don't know either. But like, he ended up going to prison after that. So, you know, you look him up, and again, they have the initial arrest in January of 2011, and it just says drug court. It said that he was, you know, released from that, not released, but you know what I mean? Like that ended in December of 2014.
Yeah, the completed drug court was completed.
Right.
Yeah.
In 2014, nothing. Like there are no other cases, charges, anything. And then September 22nd, 2020, like I said, same charge, same case number.
Yeah. I mean, it's gotta be a jurisdictional thing that I don't know about.
Yeah. So in any case, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And this is all in 2020, but he was released just last month on April 11th, 2022. And he's presumably still in Oklahoma. As for Mandy Stokes, her case is currently with the Oakland Cold Case Unit. Investigators never were able to find any additional compelling evidence to link Aaron to the crime. And like Deb said, it doesn't really seem like they looked too hard into other possibilities. But that doesn't mean this case is hopeless. The Stokes family keeps Mandy in their heart. They hold out hope that they'll get answers. Whatever happened to Mandy was done by a person, a human, someone who has presumably been sitting with the knowledge for 15 years. That person may have told other people. That person may decide to come clean on their own. Alicia Mandy Stokes hasn't been forgotten, and hopefully her loved ones receive the answers they're searching for someday soon. Alicia Mandy Stokes has been missing from Oakland, California since November 25th, 2007. Mandy is a white female with brown hair and green eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she had blonde highlights in her hair. Her ears and belly button are pierced. She has a scar on her forearm, a birthmark on her thigh, and a tattoo on her wrist. Mandy was 33 when she went missing. She would be 47 today. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Mandy Stokes, please contact the Oakland Police Department at 510-238-3641. You can see all of the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. Our research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.